So our guest today is the Chief Executive Officer of the American Medical Association, the nation's largest physician organization. He has served in this position since 2011. Prior to serving at the AMA, our guest today spent 22 years at Harvard Medical School, receiving both clinical and research training, serving as a tenured professor, and as director of the National Institute of Health-sponsored Harvard Digestive Diseases Center. He also served as dean of the University of Chicago Medical School and then CEO of the Medical Center. He and his wife, Vicky, are the proud parents of two beautiful children, and one is here today, Max. Say hi, Max. Just wave to everybody. And equally important, his future wife, Audra. So let's give them a round of applause to Max and Audra. And then our guest speaker and Vicky have another child, Alexis, who could not be with us today. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. James Madeira. Thank you. Okay, doctor.
Well, thanks very much, and good afternoon on this beautiful spring Chicago afternoon. It's really a pleasure to be here, particularly as Jay pointed out, the change in healthcare in America right now is really head spinning. The American Medical Association has its national headquarters here in Chicago at the AMA Plaza on Wabash, right on the river here, where 900 employees work each day to advance the future of healthcare in everything from ethics to education to innovative tools that support physician development and improve the delivery of care. Add to that our advocacy office in D.C., which consists of 100 others that work with regulators, the White House, all the congressional offices, to affirm our mission to promote the art and science of medicine and the betterment of public health. Now, if that sounds like a lot, it is. Healthcare is incredibly complex, or as someone of prominence recently remarked, no one knew healthcare could be so complicated. I've spent my career in medicine, but the current pace of change, as they say, is just staggering. And we see weekly, if not daily, policies that are changed or proposed that would represent dramatic shifts in the care for tens of millions of Americans. In fact, I've not seen my Twitter since I've come in here, so who knows how the landscape has changed. Now, the political drama around healthcare always grabs the headlines, but we have to always remember what the stakes are. One in three Americans have high blood pressure. One in three also has prediabetes, the precursor of diabetes, and 9 out of 10 of those that have prediabetes don't know that they do. So at a minimum, it's likely that one-third of this room is either hypertensive and or prediabetic. You're welcome. And Cheryl, could you save one of those cannolis for me? Disease burden in the last half century has shifted from episodic to chronic diseases like these two, hypertension and prediabetes. And our healthcare spending this year will approximate $3 trillion, roughly 18% of our GDP. And that's by far the highest global spending per capita. If the U.S. healthcare system itself were floated out on an island, it would be the fifth largest economy in the world. So what do we get for that investment? Life expectancy in the U.S. ranks 31st globally. We're behind Costa Rica, Iceland, and most of Europe. So Chicago and Illinois are a microcosm of these health changes, sharing roughly the same frequency of hypertension and prediabetes. And additionally, 20% of students in Chicago public schools are obese, and that rises to 30% in our city's most underserved communities. Adults living in affluent Chicago neighborhoods live on average about 5 years longer than those in communities where jobs, resources, and access to health care is more scarce. So we have these profound health challenges in this country, and that's what makes this national debate around health care and health care policy so important. The AMA has been central in this debate, helping to create a system to better meet the needs of patients as well as physicians. We aspire to a new technological state crafted with input from physicians that better connects patient to doctor and helps people with chronic disease make better lifestyle choices so they can lead happier and healthier lives. So what should reform look like? Well, it's policy, but it's also community. The AMA was a early and consistent supporter of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, because it aligned with our longstanding principles. And because we know that people without health insurance live sicker and die younger. So that's an easy call. We're against people living sicker and dying younger. And therefore, we strongly argue for quality coverage and affordable coverage. Now, the ACA is far from perfect, but it represents a significant improvement on what was the status quo at the time. So our work on health reform has focused on improving what's needed, affordability being one of the top examples, while preserving the key reforms that are necessary for patients. We go on principles, not partisan politics, and our principles include ensuring that individuals currently covered do not lose coverage, maintaining coverage for those with pre-existing conditions and young adults, protecting funding for Medicaid and other national safety net programs, stabilizing and strengthening the individual insurance market, which is critical now, and continuing to improve the cost transparency of health care. These are important issues to us because we know they're important issues for our patients. While supporting the Affordable Care Act, the AMA strongly opposed the recent health care bill, the AHCA, and would oppose any bill that jeopardized health coverage for millions of people. We make that choice not for a partisan reason, but simply based on those principles. Speaker Ryan, though he wavers on this, has said that Obamacare is the law of the land for the foreseeable future. And that would be a wonderful opportunity for all of us to step back and address the flaws in the Affordable Care Act while maintaining the positive advancements. Holding firm to our guiding principles as we work to improve the nation's health care is also consistent with the American Medical Association's history. Our founding was in the mid-19th century. We spent our first decade stamping out medical quackery, then rampant in the United States. At that time, we created the first standards for medical education in the U.S. We also developed the first code of medical ethics. Incidentally, a copy of that code, the original code, is on my wall, and it's 2 pages. The current code is 500 pages. And that captures the enormity of the complexity of healthcare today. So, yes, Mr. President, healthcare is very complicated. You can't tell the history of the AMA without talking about Chicago, though. Chicago's been our home since we moved here around 1880. And while our work in healthcare is national in focus, I think you can see the imprint of the AMA and our mission across this great city. Chicago is where we published the acclaimed Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, and its 11 subspecialty journals. These are some of the most widely read and circulated academic journals, and JAMA is now the most widely circulating general medicine journal in the world. Chicago is where we founded, more recently, the AMA's Task Force to Reduce Opioid Abuse, a coalition of more than 24 leading health organizations and state medical societies that in the past 2 years has driven the national conversation around the dangers of prescription opioid abuse and helping physicians adopt more targeted and precise prescribing practices. Chicago is where we regularly host a roundtable of top healthcare CEOs to work through payment reform and other administrative challenges. Chicago is where every June the AMA hosts representatives from every state medical society and every specialty medical society, more than 170 medical societies in all, and we discuss, debate, and adopt policy on the nation's healthcare policy. Our own University of Chicago, where I served, as Jay mentioned, is part of a 32-school consortium of leading medical schools re-engineering the structure of medical education, stitching together innovations that you can start already seeing what a medical school of the future might look like. These changes include measured competency as opposed to time in chair, introduction of the third science into medical school that supplements the basic and clinical sciences, that third science being health system science, and introducing digital platforms to optimize learning. So it's best to think of the AMA's work in the last few years as three strategic arcs: developing the critical tools and policies for the field, guiding professional and educational development for physicians, and improving health outcomes for patients with emphasis on those that are struggling with chronic disease. So that's to say, we focus on making the delivery of care more efficient and effective with the goal of allowing physicians more time to be with their patients. Now, we know from two collaborative multi-market studies that physicians value time with their patients above all else. There's nothing even close to being number two. It's time with patients that physicians in all markets, all practice types, aspire to. And that major physician frustrations, when they're identified, essentially always have to do with shifting time away from direct patient interactions. Ever-increasing administrative burdens coupled with halfway technology that complicates rather than simplifies, these have negatively and profoundly changed the experience for both patients and physicians. Now, one recent AMA study done collaboratively with Dartmouth, a time motion study, showed that on average, your physician spends 2 hours on the keyboard and other administrative tasks for every 1 hour interacting with patients. 2 to 1. Then she spends 2 more evening hours at home completing the data entry for the day. Hours that used to be spent reviewing the latest clinical research or simply decompressing with the family. It's easy to argue that American physicians have become the most expensive data entry workforce on the planet. You know, what an incredible waste. We all benefit when physicians have the right support, tools, and resources, and of course the time to deliver quality care. And that's why the AMA has created a series of digital modules which help physicians apply lean approaches to their practices, make sense of new regulations, advance their careers, and help them cope with professional burnout. Helping them adjust their practices to thrive in this rapidly changing healthcare system. We've also built partnerships with tech entrepreneurs to collaborate on the next digital breakthroughs. And we like to call this the AMA Innovation Ecosystem, which captures varied efforts in the digital space and policy and our daily work in producing tools that improve patient care. The key to this work in our innovation ecosystem is incorporating the granular understanding of the patient-physician interface in the conceptualization and early design of products. This groundbreaking work has also taken root in Chicago. 2 years ago, we helped launch the tech incubator Matter at Merchandise Mart, which is now home to more than 150 healthcare startups. At our AMA Interaction Studio there, entrepreneurs and physicians collaborate on creative digital solutions to common healthcare frustrations. Additionally, 15 months ago, the AMA launched an innovation studio in the heart of Silicon Valley called Health 2047, a date that marks the 200th year of our founding in 1847. The approach of this independently operating for-profit studio is one of iteration and design by multifunctional teams, taking carefully crafted ideas to fill existing healthcare gaps and creating prototypes, which includes testing by physicians to prove that these are worthy of further development. Engineers, coders, behavioral economists, psychologists, designers, and many others form our team at Health 2047. Current projects envision a system that provides liquidity of health data so people can access. Just as all of you can securely access your banking and investment accounts online, all the detail and analysis you can get. So why should healthcare be any different? You know, after all, it's your data, and you should be able to connect all of it to any physician you wish. The data itself also has to be transformed from its current state, which I would characterize as oceans of data and puddles of information. It has to be transformed to effectively organize clinical data needed at the point of care, which does not happen today. The goal of these efforts, both in Chicago and Silicon Valley, is simple. It's bringing the physician perspective to innovation so that tools that come over the transom actually help the system and understand the granularity of healthcare delivery. Our second strategic arc guides professional development in medicine, whether for experienced physicians, residents, or medical students. Recent surveys have shown that the majority of physicians consider their careers as a calling, not just some simple choice. Three-quarters of physicians are motivated, above all else, by the opportunity to help people. And one-third became doctors because of a personal or family illness or injury. Actually, I'm in that category. And this is what makes medicine so special and unique. I talked already about our medical school consortium. Finally, our third arc is our work to improve outcomes for patients. This includes partnerships, new partnerships with the American Diabetes Association, the Centers for Disease Control, the Ad Council, and others to raise awareness about this shift to chronic disease that I spoke about earlier, you know, particularly the threat of high blood pressure and prediabetes. Our work is helping physicians and care teams improve the accuracy of blood pressure readings as well as its control, work which our studies show would one day prevent a third of all strokes and a quarter of all cardiovascular accidents and events and a quarter of deaths. We've now organized a formalized partnership with the American Heart Association, and we will launch in 2017 to scale these efforts nationally. Our work in prediabetes focuses on helping people identify the risks and getting them the help they need to make better choices about their health. We're partnering with community organizations like the WISE in high-risk communities to identify people living with prediabetes and refer them to physicians, help them enroll in proven diabetes prevention programs. Programs we have seen help at-risk children and adults, and we hope soon may be available in every community across the country, including right here in Chicago. We recently worked with federal regulators to secure reimbursement for diabetes prevention programs for patients covered by Medicare. And now the federal government has agreed to cover this for all federal employees. That coverage will begin in January of 2018. And millions have seen our national pre-diabetes campaign with the Ad Council. 350,000 have taken our recent simple assessment. If you go to doihaveprediabetes.org, you can have the assessment. And I encourage everyone to do the same. Take it, evaluate your risks, and if necessary, follow up with your physician. That's doihaveprediabetes.org. Chicago is well positioned to be a leader in this emerging revolution in healthcare, in education and treatment, in point-of-care testing, telemedicine, in tracking, transforming emerging health trends, and in converting medical data to a cohesive, democratized, and actionable clinical record. Chicago is home to leading universities and their hospitals, to premier independent medical centers, to some of our largest pharmaceutical companies, to major insurers, home to hospital suppliers, consumer tech companies, health associations, and others. We have the amenities and resources desired to potentially attract the best entrepreneurial talent from around the country and around the world. But I have to say, this is a precarious position. It requires that we, as a city and a region, continue to invest, support, and encourage entrepreneurial spirit. So who's responsible for assuring this? A few months ago, I spoke with an MIT professor who was a thought leader. He agreed that healthcare was a systems engineering problem. His field was systems engineering. And he said that we cannot truly begin to fix a problem in a systems engineering area like healthcare without first accurately defining the boundaries of the system. First step. So what's the boundary of a system in which chronic disease now accounts for 80% of our $3 trillion spend? Where diseases flourish in communities disconnected from providers. And where almost 20% of our nation's GDP is consumed by competing public-private enterprises in this space. The answer, we agreed, is that the boundary of our healthcare system now is exactly the same as the boundary of our nation. We have to find clever ways to efficiently and effectively make connections between community assets and traditional providers, between all the institutions that service this effort. So the answer to who is responsible for ensuring Chicago's place as a national leader in healthcare, that answer is all of us. We have to make Chicago and Illinois attractive to new business and enterprising startups. We have to continue to build partnerships in medicine and beyond and look for creative ways to collaborate on a shared vision of health with our communities. And for those who are concerned about the future of healthcare in America, we want you to lend your voice to the debate, to our grassroots effort. Connect with us at patientsbeforepolitics.org. There, you can get the latest information about the changes ahead, how that might affect you. We're all in this together, and the stakes just simply could not be higher. It's your health, my health, the health of our nation. Healthcare is deeply personal. When at the University of Chicago, I was asked by a group of trustees once why the medical center was so successful in raising philanthropic support. And my answer was simple. I said, it's because everyone I speak with in every room, including this one, is preoperative. It's just a matter of timing. Once again, you're welcome. It doesn't get much more personal than that. So I'm grateful to the City Club for inviting me here to share these few thoughts and talk about the AMA in Chicago. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Now we're going to open our question and answer session. Thank you. So the first question today comes from Steve Geerman. Steve, where are you?
Geiger.
Sorry about that. Okay. Could you comment on the importance of oral health to overall health? How can dentists help our medical colleagues move towards interdisciplinary care?
Thank you. It is recognized that oral health is fundamental to overall health. You know, that happens to be one of our strongest connections with the external world, when you think about it. And it has to be connected and integrated. Dental plans are an important part of health plans.
Okay. How can the AMA help the American public understand Medicaid as a widely used good rather than something terrible for poor people?
You know, that's a great question because people, I think a lot of people out in the street would think of Medicaid in exactly the way you described, Suzette. And what that misses is that there are 74 million Americans that are on Medicaid. Medicaid funds about half the deliveries of babies in our nation. Medicaid takes care of nearly half of the elderly care at the end of life. So this is something that is really of fundamental importance to our nation. I should expand that by making the following point. When I was talking about our $3 trillion healthcare spend, I mentioned that's the highest per capita spend on the globe from the OECD nations. Well, if you look at that same group of nations, the OECD nations, you say, well, what's the percent of GDP spent by those nations on social services? Turns out we are at the absolute bottom of that list. And if you add health services and social services together, we're actually right in the middle of the pack among the OECD nations. So one way I describe this is if you think of healthcare as kind of a pyramid, and at the base of the pyramid are social services, nutrition, wellness, support for elderly education. And you think of the top of the pyramid moving into healthcare as we now think of it, and the top of the pyramid being the most complex stem cell transplants. The other OECD nations will control the costs at the top of the pyramid. A 78-year-old in England is not going to get a renal transplant. We pretend we don't do that in the United States, but where we underspend is actually at the base of that pyramid. And in a country that's now shifted to chronic disease, that's a disservice. And Medicaid is also important in that area as well.
I'm going to tell you to get comfortable because we have a lot of questions today, and usually we can categorize them together. These are all very unique questions and very different. So our next question comes from Dr. Cheryl Whitaker. And she says, on the table for the president's health reform pushes the community rating decision to states, which means that people with pre-existing conditions would face extreme difficulty finding health care coverage pre-Medicare. What's the AMA's position?
So our position is that those with pre-existing conditions need to be covered. You know, we are a civilized nation, I think. And I should say beyond that, if you look at the activities around the American Health Care Act that was pulled before it went to a vote and now is being worked on, in terms of our principles, again, putting the politics aside, but thinking of those overarching principles, it gets worse and worse with every revision. So now it's, you know, throwing pre-existing conditions to the states and not guaranteeing the panel of benefits. One can hear arguments that are shocking. arguments that if I am a man, I shouldn't have to pay for the benefit of child delivery because I don't deliver child, missing the point that delivery of children is sort of like the next asset that we're going to have as a nation. So it is, I think, a conversation that, in my sense, is that Congress, the House, will go on Easter break on the 7th in just a few days. When they come back before the 28th, there has to be a resolution to the ongoing funding of our nation. I don't think they're going to get health care straightened out in the next two or three days. And I think many people also had predicted that the AHCA and its revisions would have had a very difficult time in the Senate, even had it gone through the House.
Jake Tuohy is in the audience today, and he would like to know, what are some of the challenges that the AMA is facing with attracting new members, and how is the organization dealing with those challenges?
Yeah, thanks. One thinks of the AMA as a membership organization. We are. We have about 225,000 members. We also have something that functions more as an org of org or representationally, and that is our House of Delegates. The House of Delegates is all 50 states, societies, plus the D.C. Society. D.C. Society loves it when you point that out. And then all the specialty societies, you know, everything from, you know, cardiovascular surgery to pulmonary and whatnot. And all these societies come together, their delegates come together, and they indeed make the policy of the AMA in a legislative process each June, and also elect our president each year. And so all physicians actually are coupled to that process, the policymaking process. Others are in additional members. We think that we can also make inroads in a variety of ways. Actually, we just hired our chief experience officer, Todd Unger, who's here, Todd, for the digital experience of interacting. And there are certain things one can imagine that we're working on in utilizing Health 2047 as well, and Health 2047's asset in artificial intelligence. So one could imagine on a mobile all of the work of the JAMA and JAMA Network repurposed in infographics where you could capture the message from that paper in an infographic and do that in 60 to 120 seconds, and then have that linked automatically to CME and to your specialty society. So that we can think of a number of ways of bootstrapping ourselves into more of a 21st century view of how education and connectedness gets done.
One of the stories that we woke up to this morning was a story about Vice President Pence and Republican lawmakers working late into the night last night, once again on this issue of repealing the ACA. So let's get into that. So one question, how do you see the possible repeal of ACA affecting healthcare systems, particularly FQHCs? What's the impact on healthcare cost should the ACA be repealed? And are we headed toward a single payer system?
Well, I don't know where we're headed. It's not up to me. I can say that, you know, I think people are aware of the CBO scoring of the Affordable Care Act being repealed, where tens of millions of people, up to 20 million people that were covered, would lose their coverage. Frankly, there would be increased cost, even without considering the truth of the matter, which the cost shifts then to the private sector, to hospitals that, due to EMTALA, need to take care of people that are uninsured, so people show up in a sicker state. We as I said, support the Affordable Care Act because of these attributes. We'd like to see some things improved. President Obama, by the way, has said the same thing. You know, he's not feeling strong. Naming rights, just wants to have a good health care, if you hear what is said. And so what one possibility is that the plans currently will not move forward. I mean, we've already seen a tremendous difficulty with those plans moving forward. And perhaps one possibility is another topic, another big topic will be taken up, a topic like tax reform. And if tax reform becomes the new front and center topic, it is then the topic that's under the big tent, where all the shiny lights are and where all the knives come out in D.C. And one could hope that healthcare would move into the sideshow arena, where people actually try to work in a bipartisan way to get things done. That would be my optimistic hope.
Here's a quick follow-up. Are there other partners that you think that could be engaged to sustain the gains of the ACA or perhaps dispel the AHCA?
Yeah, I think, and we've interacted with them, the National Governors Association is an obvious one. You know, before coming to the AMA, so it was, say, 6.5 years ago, I went to a meeting of the, you know, educational directors from all 50 states. And in a panel, when the discussion was around what they see is their number one threat to education in their state, I was surprised to hear that uniformly everyone said healthcare. And it's because when you look at states' Medicaid budgets, that's typically either number one or two. I think there's an instance or two where it's number three. But between infrastructure, education, and healthcare, you have the top three categories in virtually every state, with healthcare being at the top. And then you think of states like Louisiana, where the you know, the national split between the state and the government is about 60% government, 40% state, but it varies. California is more 50-50, varies on complicated formulae. In Louisiana, it's more like 80-20, 80 coming from the government, the federal government, 20 coming from the state. So imagine a state like Louisiana deciding to decrease its spending and cutting back on Medicaid dollars. To save $2 in their budget, 10 is lost from the program. And so the National Governors Association also is I would say, if the discrepancy of view in Congress is this wide, the discrepancy of view in the National Governors Association is described as being about that wide. You know, there are a lot of Republican governors with Medicaid expansion. And so I think that they would be one very powerful ally, and we're already talking with them.
Can you talk about what some of the flaws of the ACA are that perhaps need to be corrected?
Yeah, so there are complex ones and simple ones. So a simple one is affordability. And the affordability problem really has to do with the fact that we don't have, you know, we don't have all the healthy people in the system. That, you know, that's the way insurance works. It's the way your fire insurance works for your home. And so one needs to have substantial incentives for people that are young, healthy, to get health insurance. And also for employers to provide health insurance. That would drive costs down. I think other things that would drive costs down, about $800 billion a year spent with administrative waste. So I'll give an example. Say there are five patients having the same hip replacement operation with the same device in the same operating room by the same surgeon at the same institution. Each one of those five surgeries is probably a completely different economic transaction. If it's Blues or Aetna, it depends on, you know, the market share and what the negotiation was. If it's Medicaid, it probably doesn't quite cover the cost, and there's, you know, cost transference from the extra, so to speak, from the private insurers, the Blues. So it's a complete and total mess in terms of transparency of cost, and a lot of this has to do with grinding and administrative fees as well. So we talked about, I was talking with Cheryl about prior authorization. Prior authorization where on your plan you're going to get a device or you're going to take a drug, and your plan needs that some prior authorization because they think it's a matter of safety and maybe it's an inappropriate use of that drug. Well, there are some safety concerns that are covered by prior authorization, shouldn't go away, but it's by no means right-sized. We did a study recently that showed that in a normal practice, for every physician, there are 16 hours a week, 2 days a week, either by that physician or that physician's extenders, that are dealing with prior authorizations. There's a Blues program in Western New York that has cut out 200 prior authorizations because it, you know, kept the ones that are of highest meaning to them. A United Health group decided that they would cut out prior authorization in much of their oncology practice and substitute it with information for the physicians, which they thought had more impact. So, you know, examples like that. And then there are complex ones like something called the family glitch. I love these names. The family glitch is that if there is a breadwinner in the family and he or she has four others in that family, that if they're getting insurance through an employer, that they, if they spend less than 9.5% of their income, that's fine. They, you know, they don't get a subsidy. But that's, so they're judged as an individual even though they need a family plan. And if you go from an individual to a family plan, you're generally going from about $6,000 a year to something like $17,000. You know, the median income in the country is $50,000 to $52,000. So those numbers don't work. So a lot of those kinds of things, I think, need to be corrected and can be.
So this next question is related to immigration. The Trump administration's immigration policies have immigrant families fearful of seeking health care for fear that they might be detained or deported. Does the AMA take a stand on this issue? And if so, what is it?
Yeah, I mean, I'll even deepen the point. About a quarter of practicing physicians in the United States are international medical grads. And international medical grads who take the same exams are, you know, tested heavily and certified, also tend to gravitate to more than the nation's graduates do, to sites that are underserved, rural areas, critical part of our healthcare system. And then to add on to that, people that are fearing for their healthcare needs, if they go see a doctor, step out of the house. So this, again, does not align with our policies of coverage and care when you need it, where you need it, and the right time of care.
Okay. So here's an interesting topic that you actually mentioned, ethics. Have you focused on ethical issues? So things like quality of extended life, CRISPR regulation, and diversity of life expectancy in neighborhoods, North Lawndale versus the Gold Coast.
You know, we think these are, you know, important issues of health equity. We have an entire group in the ethics area at the AMA, and they work with our house to formulate policies around these topics. We do have new elements that come across the transom, like CRISPR, all the time. CRISPR, as you know, is a means of altering genetic sequence with a ease that 10 years ago people would have said this would be a dream. This couldn't do it. It was impossible to do that. And now that can be done. And in fact, I was shocked to learn that in high school science fairs, we're now seeing genetically modified plants and microbes being brought in as projects by our high school students buying CRISPR kits online. So this really creates another form of an ethical dilemma. There is a high-level panel convened to think about the appropriate use of CRISPR approaches on human tissues and human organs and in living human beings. But that's why it's 500 pages now. Yeah.
So City Club member Mel Katz would like to know, how do doctors and hospitals survive with medical payment from Medicare, which is 20 to 40% of their billed amount?
These are obviously very small margin businesses. They have small margins, but also they're capital intensive. So it puts a huge amount of pressure on the organizations. And that's why our view is let's get the waste, administrative duplication, the right sizing and prior authorization, the prevention. I didn't mention that. Some economists will say that there's not much to be saved by preventing disease. I don't think long term, but we had a score that was verified by the CBO in prediabetes, which was the basis of the federal government's willingness to reimburse for diabetes prevention programs, because it does save money. The other thing I'd have to say here is I think we also think of the system in a overly simplified way. We think about healthcare as $3 trillion. So we think of only the cost side. But if we do the right thing, we prevent disease, we get people back to their families and productive, we also affect the productivity side, and we should be measuring that. And so we should be thinking of healthcare as the totality of the $18.5 trillion GDP. And there's a cost side and a revenue side, and we should be considering both.
So our time is beginning to run short, so we're just going to go with one final question. And the question is, how can technology break down the walls that prevent access to patient data? Current barriers are more cultural than technological.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And there are some incentives to keep it isolated, too. If Institution X possesses my medical information, it's a slight disincentive for me to go to Institution Y. So there's some data blocking going on as well. One of the projects, both in Chicago and on the West Coast, there are two projects that interact that are trying to use new approaches to technology to make these data more liquid and more assembled. And we think of the electronic health record as, some new technological thing. Epic, which is the largest, I hope Judy Faulkner's not here. Epic, which is the largest selling electronic health record in the nation, has code. Its code is from the late 70s. And these were built up from sort of claims and billing systems. And so they're good for claims and billing and risk mitigation, but the use of and handling of clinical data are not really great. My friends at the Brigham switched to Epic just recently, spending a few $100 million from their old homebrew. And I said to them, why would you do that? And their answer was the right answer. It was that Epic is the cream of the crap.
So why don't we give a great big thank you to our guest speaker for today.
Have him pick one out.